to be loaded 14 a week into Marty's car and taken to the dump. She still had the plugs under the stairs. And then came the Rolls-Royce. Jess could at least see the sense in that one. Marty would spray it metallic grey, then rent himself out as a chauffeur for weddings and funerals. He bought it off eBay from a man in the Midlands and made it halfway down the M6 before it conked out. Something to do with the starter motor, they said, peering under the bonnet. But the more they looked at it, the more seemed wrong with it. The first winter, it spent on the drive. Mice got into the upholstery, so they needed money to replace the back seats before we could rent it out. And then it turned out that replacement upholstered Rolls-Royce seats were about the only thing you couldn't get on eBay. So it sat there in the garage, a daily reminder of how they never quite managed to get ahead. She'd taken over the money when Marty had got ill and started to spend most of each day in bed. Depression was an illness. Everyone said so. Although, from what his mate said, he didn't seem to suffer it on the two evenings he still managed to drag himself to the pub. She had peeled all the bank statements from their envelopes and retrieved the savings book from its place in the hall desk and had finally seen for herself the trouble they were in. She tried to talk to him a couple of times, but he just pulled the duvet over his head and said he couldn't cope. It was around then that he'd suggested he might go home to his mum's for a bit. If she was honest, Jess was relieved to see him go. It was hard enough coping with Nicky, who was still a silent, skinny wraith, tansy and two jobs. "Go," she'd said, stroking his hair. She remembered thinking how long it had been since she'd touched him. "Go for a couple of weeks. You'll feel better for a bit of a break." He had looked at her silently, his eyes red-rimmed, and squeezed her hand. That had been 2 years ago. Neither of them had ever seriously raised the possibility of him coming back. She tried to keep things normal until Tansy went to bed, asking what she'd had to eat at Natalie's, telling her what Norman had done while she was out. She combed Tansy's hair, then sat on her bed and read her an old Harry Potter, as if she were a much younger child, and for once Tansy didn't tell her that actually she'd rather do some maths. When Jess was sure that Tansy was asleep, she rang the hospital. The nurse said that Nicky was comfortable. X-rays had shown no evidence that his lung was punctured. The small facial fracture would have to heal by itself. She rang Marty, who listened in silence, then asked, "Does he still wear all that stuff on his face?" "He wears a bit of mascara, yes." There was a long silence. "Don't say it, Marty. Don't you dare say it." She put the phone down before he could. And then the police rang at 9:45 and said that Fisher had denied all knowledge. "There were 14 witnesses," she said, her voice tight with the effort of not shouting, "including the man who runs the fish and chip shop. They jumped my son. There were 4 of them." "Yes, but witnesses are only any use to us if they can identify the perpetrators, madam. And Mr. Brent says it wasn't clear who was actually doing the fighting." He let out a sigh as if these sort of calls were an endless chore, as if she should know what teenage boys were like. "I have to tell you, madam, the Fishers claim your son started it." "He's about as likely to start a fight as the Dalai bloody Lama. We're talking about a boy who can't put a duvet in its cover without worrying it might hurt someone." "We can only act on the evidence, madam." His flat tone said he had heard it all before. The Fishers, she thought as she slammed down the phone. With their reputation, she'd be lucky if a single person remembered what they'd seen. For a moment, Jess let her head fall into her hands. They would never let up, and it would be Tansy next once she started secondary school. She would be a prime target with her maths and her oddness and her total lack of guile. The thought of it made her go cold. She thought about Marty's sledgehammer in the garage. She thought about how it would feel to walk down to the Fisher's house, and the phone rang. She snatched it up. "What now? Are you going to tell me he beat himself up too? Is that it?" "Mrs. Thomas," she blinked. "Mrs. Thomas, it's Mr. Spangarai."
Oh, Mr. Spangarai, I'm sorry, it's not a great time." She held out her hand in front of her. It was shaking.
I'm sorry to call you so late, but it's a matter of some urgency. I have discovered something of interest. It's called a maths Olympiad. He spoke the words carefully. A what? It's a new thing. In Scotland, for gifted students, a maths competition, and we still have time to enter Tansy.
A maths competition? Jess closed her eyes.
You know, that's really nice, Mr. Tsvangirai, but we have quite a lot going on here right now, and I don't think I...
Mrs. Thomas, hear me out. The prizes are £500, £1,000, and £5,000. £5,000. If she won, you'd have at least the first year of your St. Anne's school fees sorted out.
Say that again?
He repeated it. Jess sat down on the chair as he explained in greater depth.
This is an actual thing?
It is an actual thing.
And you really think she could do it?
There is a category especially for her age group. I cannot see how she could fail.
£5,000. A voice sang in her head. Enough to get her through at least the first year. What's the catch?
No catch. Well, you have to do advanced maths, obviously. But I can't see that this will be a problem for Tansy. She stood up and sat down again. And of course you would have to travel to Scotland.
Details, Mr. Tsvangirai. Details. Her head was spinning. This is for real, right? This isn't a joke.
I am not a funny man, Mrs. Thomas.
Fuck. Fuck! Mr. Tsvangirai, you are an absolute beauty. She could hear his embarrassed laugh.
So, what do we do now? Well, they waived the qualifying test after I sent over some examples of Tansy's work.
I understand they are very keen to have children from less advantaged schools.
And between you and me, it is, of course, an enormous benefit that she's a girl. But we have to decide quickly. You see, this year's Olympiad is only 5 days away. 5 days. The deadline for registration at St. Anne's was tomorrow. She stood in the middle of the room, thinking. Then she ran upstairs, pulled Mr. Nichols's money from its nest among her tights, and before she could think, she stuffed it into an envelope, scrawled a note, and wrote Admissions Office, St. Anne's, in careful letters on the front. She would drop it in on the way to clean tomorrow. She would pay it back. Every penny. But right now, she didn't have a choice. That night, Jess sat at the kitchen table, studied the figures, and worked out a rough plan. She looked up the cost of 3 train tickets to Edinburgh, laughed a bit hysterically, then looked up coach tickets, £187, including the £13 it would cost to get to the coach station, and the cost of putting Norman in kennels for a week. £94. She put the palms of her hands into her eye sockets and let them stay there for a bit. And then, when the children were asleep, she dug out the keys to the Rolls-Royce, went outside, brushed the mouse droppings off the driver's seat and tried the ignition. It turned over on the third attempt. Jess sat in the garage, that always smelt of damp, even in high summer, surrounded by old garden furniture, bits of car, plastic buckets and spades and the empty boxes for air conditioning units, letting the engine run and thinking. Then she leant forward and peeled back the faded tax disc. It was almost 2 years out of date, and she was uninsured. She stared at it, then turned off the ignition and sat in the dark as the engine ticked down and the smell of oil gradually faded from the air. And she thought, for the 100th time, do the right thing.
Chapter 8. Ed. ed.nichols@mayfly.com. Don't forget what I told you. Can remind you of deets if you lose the card. Diana1@yahoo.com. I won't forget. Whole night engraved on my memory. Smiley wink. ed.nichols@mayfly.com. Did you do what I told you? Diana1@yahoo.com. Just sorting now. ed.nichols@mayfly.com. Let me know if you get good results. Diana1@yahoo.com. Well, based on your past performance, I'd be amazed if it was anything but. Cheeky smile. Diana1@yahoo.com. Nobody's ever done for me what you did for me. Ed.Nichols@mayfly.com. Really, it was nothing. Diana1@yahoo.com. You want to hook up again next weekend? Ed.Nichols@mayfly.com. Bit busy at the mo, I'll let you know. Diana1@yahoo.com. I think it worked out well for both of us. Cheeky wink. The detective let him finish reading the two sheets of paper, then slid them toward Paul Wilkes, Ed's lawyer. Have you got any comment on those, Mr. Nichols? There was something excruciating about seeing private emails laid out in an official document. The eagerness of his early replies, the barely veiled double entendre, the smiley faces, what was he, 14? You don't have to say anything, Paul said. That whole exchange could be about anything. Ed pushed the documents away from him. Let me know if you get good results. I could have been telling her to do something sexual. It could be like email sex. At 11:14 a.m.? So? In an open-plan office? So I'm uninhibited. The detective removed his glasses and gave him a hard look. Email sex? Really? That's what you were doing here? Well, no, not in that case. But that's not the point. I would suggest it is totally the point, Mr. Nichols. There are reams of this stuff. There's a paper trail of the two of you meeting twice. You talk about keeping in touch, he flicked through the papers, to see if I can help you out some more. But it's not how it sounds. She was depressed. She was having a bad time getting rid of her ex. I just wanted to make things a little easier for her. I keep telling you. Just a few more questions. They had questions, all right. They wanted to know how often he had met Diana, where they had gone, what the exact nature of their relationship was. They didn't believe him when Ed said he didn't know much about her life. They didn't believe him when he said he knew nothing about her brother. Oh, come on, he protested. You've never had a relationship based on sex? Miss Lewis doesn't say it was based on sex. She says the two of you were involved in a close and intense relationship, that you had known each other since your college days, and that you were determined to make her go ahead with this deal, that you pressed it on her. She says she had no idea that in taking your advice she was doing anything illegal. But she's making it sound like we had much more of a relationship than we did, and I didn't force her to do anything. So you admit that you gave her the information? I'm not saying that. I'm just saying... I think what my client is saying is that he cannot be held responsible for any misconceptions Miss Lewis might have held about their relationship, Paul Wilkes interjected, or what information she might have passed on to her brother. And we were not having a relationship, not that kind of relationship. The detective shrugged. You know what? I don't really care what the nature of your relationship was. I don't care if you nobbed her halfway to next Wednesday. What is of interest to me, Mr. Nichols, is that you are on record as having given this young woman information which, on the 28th of February, she told a friend was going to bring us some serious profit, and which her and her brother's funds bank account show did in fact bring them some serious profit. An hour later, bailed for a fortnight, Ed sat in Paul Wilkes's office. Paul poured them both a whiskey, and they sat in silence while Ed drank his. He was becoming oddly used to the taste of strong alcohol in daylight hours. I can't be held responsible for what she told her brother. I can't go around checking whether every potential partner is a brother who works in finance. I was trying to help her. Well, you certainly did that. But the SFA and the SOCA won't care what your motives were, Ed. Can we stop talking in acronyms? I have no idea who you're talking about. Well, basically... try and imagine every serious crime-fighting body that has anything to do with finance or crime. That's basically who is investigating you right now. You make it sound like I'm actually going to be charged. Ed put the whiskey on the table beside him. I think it's extremely likely, yes. and I think we may be in court pretty quickly. They're trying to speed up these cases. Ed stared at him. Then his head sank into his hands.
This is a nightmare. I just wanted her to go away, Paul. I want this to go away.
Well, the best we can hope for at the moment is that we can convince them that you're basically just a geek who is in over his head. Great. You got any better ideas? Ed shook his head. Then just sit tight.
I need to do something, Paul. I need to get back to work. I don't know what to do if I'm not working. I'm going nuts down here in Nowheresville.
Like I said, I know the prosecutors want to get this sewn up quickly. But if I were you, I'd stay put for now. The SFA may well leak this, and then the shit really is going to hit the fan. The media are going to be all over you like a bad suit. The best thing you can do is hide down there in Nowheresville for another week or so. Paul scribbled a note on his legal pad. Ed gazed at the upside-down writing.
Do you think this will get into the papers?
I don't know, probably. It might be a good idea to talk to your family anyway, just so they're prepared for any negative publicity. Ed rested his hands on his knees.
I can't.
You can't what?
Tell my dad about all this.
He's sick. This would... He shook his head. When he finally looked up, Paul was watching him steadily.
Well, that's got to be your decision. But as I said, I think it would be wise for you to remain somewhere out of reach if and when it all blows up. Mayfly obviously doesn't want you anywhere near its offices until it's all sorted out. There's too much money riding on SFAX. So, you need to steer clear of anyone associated with the company. No calls, no emails. And if anyone does happen to locate you, for God's sake, don't say anything. To anyone.
He tapped his pen, signalling the end of the conversation. So, basically, I hide in the middle of nowhere, keep shtum, and twiddle my thumbs until I get sent to prison. The lawyer just stood, closed the file on his desk. Well, we're putting our best team on it. We'll do our best to make sure it doesn't come to that. Ed stood blinking on the steps of Paul's office, surrounded by office workers and lead-stained buildings, couriers tugging helmets from sweaty heads, bare-legged secretaries laughing on their way to eat sandwiches in the park, and felt a sudden pang for his old life. The one with his Nespresso machine in his office, and his secretary nipping out for sushi, and his apartment with the views over the city, and the worst thing that afternoon being the prospect of having to lie on the couch in his office and listen to the suits drone on about profit and loss. He had never really measured his life by that of anyone else, but now he felt cripplingly envious of the people around him with their everyday concerns, their ability to get on a tube back to their own homes, their families, the simple pleasures of going for a meal with friends, to stretch out in front of the television with his arm around someone. What did he have? Weeks of being stuck in an empty house, with nobody to talk to, facing the prospect of imminent prosecution. He missed work more than he'd ever missed his wife. He missed it like a constant mistress. He missed having a routine. He thought back to the previous week, to waking up on his sofa at beachfront with no idea how he had got there, his mouth as dry as if it had been packed with cotton wool, his glasses neatly folded on the coffee table. It was the third time in as many weeks that he'd been so drunk he couldn't remember how he'd got home. The first time he had woken with empty pockets. He checked his phone. New, only three imported contacts. There were two voicemail messages from Gemma. Nobody else had called. Ed sighed and pressed delete, then set off along the sun-baked pavement toward the car park. He wasn't really a drinker. Lara had always insisted alcohol gave you belly fat and complained that he snored if he had more than two. But he wanted a drink right now, like he had rarely wanted anything. Ed sat for a while in his empty flat, got a bite to eat at a pizza restaurant, sat again in his flat, and then he climbed back into his car and drove towards the coast. Deanna Lewis danced before him the whole way out of London. How could he have been so stupid? Why had he not thought about the possibility that she would tell someone else? Or was he actually missing something more sinister here? Had she and her brother planned this? Was it some sort of psychotic revenge strategy for dumping her? He drove and his brain hummed with questions. His skin prickled with anger, and with every mile it grew. He might as well have given her the keys to his flat, his bank account details, like his ex-wife, and let her wipe him out. That would actually have been better. At least he would have kept his job, his friend. Shortly before the Godalming exit, overcome with rage, he pulled over on the motorway and dialed her mobile number. He had to try to remember it, as the authorities had taken his old phone, with all the contacts on, as part of their search for evidence.
What the hell did you think you were doing?
But the number was dead. Ed sat in a lay-by, his phone in his hand, feeling his rage dissipate. He hesitated, then rang Ronan's number. It was one of only a handful he knew off by heart. It rang several times before he answered. Ronan.
I'm not allowed to talk to you, Ed.
He sounded weary.
Yeah, I know. I just wanted to say.
Say what?
What do you want to say, Ed?
The anger in his voice was a silencer.
You know what? I don't actually care so much about the insider trading thing, although obviously it's a bloody disaster for the company. But you are my mate, my oldest friend. I would never have done that to you.
A click, and the phone went dead. Ed sat there and allowed his head to drop onto the wheel for a few minutes. He waited until the humming in his mind leached away to nothing. And then he indicated, pulled out slowly, and drove towards beachfront. What do you want, Lara? He didn't say it like a question.
Hey, baby, how are you?
Not so good.
Oh, no. What is the matter?
He never knew if it was an Italian thing, but she had a way, his ex-wife, of making you feel better. She would cradle your head, run her fingers through your hair, fuss around you, cluck maternally. By the end, it had irritated him. But now, on the empty road at dead of night, he felt nostalgic for it. It's a work thing.
Oh, a work thing.
That instinctive bristle in her voice. It's fine, Lara. How are you?
Mama is driving me crazy, and there is a problem with the roof at home.
Any jobs? She made a sound with her teeth against her lips.
I got a call back for a West End show, and they say I look too old. Too old?
You don't look too old.
I know. I can look 16. Baby, I need to talk to you about the roof.
Lara, it's your place. You got a settlement.
But they say it's going to cost lots of money. Lots of money. I have nothing.
He kept his voice steady. What happened to the settlement?
There is nothing. My brother needed some money for his business, and you know Papi's health is not good. And then I had some credit cards.
All of it?
I don't have enough for the roof. It's going to leak this winter, they said. Eduardo?
Well, you could always sell the print you took from my apartment in December. His solicitor implied it was his own fault for not changing the locks on the doors. Everyone else did, apparently.
I was sad, Eduardo. I miss you. I just wanted a reminder of you.
Right. Of the man you said you couldn't stand to even look at anymore.
I was angry when I said that.
She pronounced it angry. By the end, she was always angry. He rubbed at his eyes, flicked the indicator to signal his exit onto the coast road.
I just wanted some reminders of when we were happy.
You know, maybe the next time you miss me, you could take away like a framed photo of us, not a £14,000 limited edition print of Mousy Tongue. Her voice dropped to a whisper. It filled the dark confines of the car, almost unbearably intimate.
Don't you care that I have no one to turn to?
Her voice was feline, a soft, sad growl. It made his balls tighten reflexively, and she knew it. Ed glanced in his rearview mirror. Well, why don't you ask Jim Leonards?
What?
His wife called me. She's not very happy, funnily enough.
It was only once. Once I went out with him, and it's nobody's business who I date.
He heard her roar of outrage, could picture her, one perfectly manicured hand raised, fingers splayed in frustration at having to deal with the most annoying man on earth.
You left me. Am I supposed to be a nun my whole life?
You left me, Lara. On the 27th of May, on the way back from Paris, remember?
Details. You always twist my words with details. This is exactly why I had to leave you.
I thought it was because I only loved my work and didn't understand human emotions.
I left you because you have a tiny dick. Tiny, tiny dick. Like a prawn.
You mean prawn?
Prawn, crayfish, whatever is smallest thing, tiny.
Then I think you actually mean shrimp.
You know, given you just walked off with a valuable limited edition print, I think you could at least have granted me lobster.
But sure, whatever.
He heard the Italian curse, the clumsy slamming down of her phone. He drove for several miles that later he would not recall driving, and then he sighed, turned on the radio, and fixed his gaze on the seemingly endless black road ahead. Gemma rang just as he was turning down the coast road. Her name flashed up on the hands-free, and Ed answered before he'd had time to think about why he shouldn't. It felt like every time his phone rang, it was just so somebody could yell at him.
Don't tell me, you're really busy.
I'm driving.
And you have a hands-free thing. Mum wanted to know if you're going to be there for their anniversary lunch.
What anniversary lunch?
Oh, come on, Ed. I told you about it months ago. I'm sorry, I haven't got access to my diary right now.
He could hear her taking a breath.
They're going to let Dad out next Tuesday, so Mum's doing a special lunch at home for them. She wanted us to be there. You said you'd be able to come.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what? You remember? Or, yeah, you're coming?
He tapped his fingers on the steering wheel.
I don't know. Look, Dad was asking for you yesterday. I told him you're tied up with a work project, but he's so frail, Ed. This is really important to him, to both of them.
Gemma, I've told you. Her voice exploded into the interior of the car.
Yeah, I know, you're too busy. You've told me you've got a lot on. You've told me you've got stuff going on.
I have got stuff going on. You have no idea.
Oh, no, I couldn't possibly hope to understand, could I? Just the stupid social worker who doesn't earn a six-figure fucking salary. This is our dad, Ed. This is the man who sacrificed everything to buy you a fucking education. He thinks the sun shines out of your backside and is not going to last much longer. You need to get down there and show your face and say the things that sons are meant to say to their dying fathers, okay?
He's not dying.
How the fuck would you know? You haven't been to see him in 2 months.
Look, I will go. It's just I've got to...
Why do you keep making excuses?
I'm not making excuses, Jem.
Bullshit! You're a businessman. You make stuff happen. Make this happen. Or I swear I...
I'm losing you, Jem. Sorry, the reception's really patchy here. He began to make shh noises.
One lunch, she said, her social work voice on, all calm and conciliatory. One little lunch, Ed. That's all I'm asking.
He spotted a police car up ahead and checked the speedometer, half braced for tangled metal. A filthy Rolls-Royce, one headlight dimmed, sat half up on the verge under the orange glow of a sodium light. A small girl stood beside it, holding an enormous dog on a lead. Her head swiveled slowly as he passed.
I do understand that you have a lot of commitments, and your job is really important. We all understand that, Mr. Big Swinging Techno Dick. But just one awkward family lunch with your sick father and your overworked, underpaid, do-gooder sister? Would that be too much to ask?
Hang on, Jem, there's an accident. Beside her, a ghostly teenager, boy, girl, with a shock of dark hair, stood with his hands in his pockets, his shoulders slumped, and, turning briefly away from a policeman who was writing something, another child. No, a small woman, her hair tied back into a scrappy ponytail. She was lifting her hands in exasperation, in a gesture that reminded him of Lara.
You are so annoying!
He had driven a further 100 yards before he understood the jolt that went through him.
He knew that woman. He racked his brain. Bar? Holiday park? He had a sudden image of her taking his keys, a memory of her removing his glasses in his house. What was she doing out there with children at this time of night? He pulled over and glanced into the rearview mirror, watching. He could just make out the group. The little girl had sat down on the dark verge, the dog, a mountainous black lump, beside her. "Ed, are you okay?" Gemma's voice broke into the silence. Afterwards, he wasn't in surely what made him do it. Perhaps it was an attempt to delay his arrival back in that empty house, to sit staring at a television screen until the small hours. Perhaps it was the strangeness of it, that making himself part of such a scene seemed no longer an odd thing to do in a life that had gone so far off the rails. Perhaps it was just that he wanted to convince himself, against all available evidence, that he was not entirely an arsehole. "Jem, I'll have to call you back. It's someone I know." He pulled over and did a 3-point turn, driving back down the dimly lit road slowly until he reached the police car. He pulled up on the other side of the road. "Hi," Ed said, lowering the window. "Can I help?"
Chapter 9. Tansy. Her happy mood had disappeared a bit when she first saw Nicky's swollen face. It didn't really look like him, and she'd had to make her eyes stay very firmly on his when they would have liked to go somewhere else, even to the stupid picture of galloping horses on the wall opposite, which didn't even look like horses. She wanted to tell him about how they'd registered at St. Anne's, but it was hard to think about it too much in that little room, with the smell of hospitals in her nose and Nicky's eye all the wrong shape. Tansy found herself thinking, "The fishers did this, the fishers did this," and she felt a bit scared because she couldn't believe anyone they knew would do this for no reason. When Nicky got up to go down the corridor, she put her hand gently into his, and even though normally he would have told her to scoot small fry, or one of the other stupid things he said, he just squeezed her fingers a bit. Mum had to have all the usual arguments with the hospital people about how, no, she wasn't his actual mum, but as good as, and no, he didn't have a social worker, and it always made Tansy feel a bit odd, like Nicky wasn't a proper part of their family, even though he was. He walked out of the room really slowly, and he remembered to thank the nurse. "Nice lad, isn't he?" she said. "Polite." Mum was gathering up his things. "That's the worst bit," she said. "He just wants to be left alone." "Doesn't really work like that round here, though, does it?" The nurse smiled at Tansy. "Take care of your brother, eh?" As she walked towards the main entrance behind him, Tansy wondered what it said about their family when every single conversation they had now seemed to end with a funny look and the words, "Take care." Mum made dinner and gave Nicky 3 different coloured pills to take, and they sat watching television on the sofa together. It was total wipeout, which normally made Nicky pretty much wee himself laughing, but he had barely spoken since they returned home, and she didn't think it was because his jaw hurt. Mum was busy upstairs. Tansy could hear her dragging drawers out and going backwards and forwards across the landing. She was so busy she didn't even notice it was way past bedtime. She nudged Nicky very gently with her finger. "Does it hurt?"
"Does what hurt?"
"Your face."
"What do you mean?"
He looked at her like he didn't know what she was talking about.
"Well, it's a funny shape."
"So's yours. Does that hurt?"
"Ha ha."
"I'm fine, Titch. Drop it." And then when she stared at him,
"Really, just forget it. I'm fine."
Mum came in and put the lead on Norman. He was lying on the sofa and didn't want to get up, and it took her about 4 goes to drag him out of the door. Tansy was going to ask her if she was taking him for a walk, but then the really funny bit was on where the wheel knocks the contestants off their little pedestals into the water, and she forgot. Then Mum came back in. "Okay, kids, get your jackets." "Jackets? Why?" Because we're leaving, for Scotland. She made it sound perfectly normal. Nicky didn't even look round from the television. We're leaving for Scotland. He pointed the remote control at the screen just to check. Yep, we're going to drive. But we haven't got a car. We're taking the Rolls. Nicky glanced at Tansy, then back at Mum. But you haven't got insurance. I've been driving since I was 12 years old, and I've never had an accident. Look, we'll stick to the B roads and do most of it overnight. As long as nobody pulls us over, we'll be fine. They both stared at her. But you said... I know what I said, but sometimes the ends justify the means. What does that mean? Mum threw her hands up in the air. There's a maths competition that could change our lives, and it's in Scotland. Right now, we haven't got the money for the fares. That's the truth of it. I know it's not ideal to drive, and I'm not saying it's right. But unless you two have a better idea, then let's just get into the car and get on with it. Don't we need to pack? It's all in the car. Tansy knew Nicky was thinking what she was thinking, that Mum had finally gone mad. But she had read somewhere that mad people were like sleepwalkers. It was best not to disturb them. So she nodded, really slowly, like this was all making perfect sense, and she fetched her jacket, and they walked through the back door and into the garage, where Norman was sitting in the back seat and giving them the look that said, "Yeah, me too." She climbed in. It smelt a bit musty, and she didn't really want to put her hands down on the seats, because she had read somewhere that mice wee all the time, like non-stop, and mouse wee could give you about 800 diseases. "Can I just run and get my gloves?" she said. Mum looked at her like she was the crazy one, but she nodded, so Tansy ran and put them on and thought she probably felt a bit better. Nicky eased his way gingerly into the front seat and wiped at the dust on the dashboard with his fingers. Then she climbed out, closed and locked the garage securely, then sat and thought for a minute. "Tans, have you got a pen and paper?" She fished around in her bag and handed her one. Mum didn't want her to see what she was writing, but Tansy peeped through the seats. "Fisher, you little waste of skin, I have told the police that if anyone breaks in, it will be you and they are watching." She got out of the car and pinned it to the bottom part of the door, where it wouldn't be visible from the street. Then she climbed back into the half-eaten driver's seat and, with a low purr, the Rolls set off into the night, leaving the glowing little house behind them. It took them about 10 minutes to work out that Mum had forgotten how to drive. The things that even Tansy knew, mirror, signal, manoeuvre, she kept doing in the wrong order. And she drove leaning forwards over the steering wheel and clutching it like the grannies who drove at 15 miles per hour around the town centre and scraped their doors on the pillars in the municipal car park. They passed the Rose and Crown, the industrial estate with the 5-man car wash, and the carpet warehouse. Tansy pressed her nose to the window. They were officially leaving town. The last time she had left town was on the school journey to Durdledore, when Melanie Abbott was sick all down herself in the coach and started a vomit chain reaction around the whole of 5C. "Just keep calm," Mum muttered to herself. "Nice and calm." "You don't look calm," said Nicky. He was playing Nintendo, his thumbs a blur on each side of the little glowing screen. "Nicky, I need you to map read. Don't play Nintendo right now." "Well, surely we just go north." "But where is north? I haven't driven around here for years. I need you to tell me where I should be going." He glanced up at the signpost. "Do we want the M3? "I don't know. I'm asking you." "Let me see." Tansy reached through from the back and took the map from Nicky's hands. "What way up do I hold it?" They drove round the roundabout twice while she wrestled with the map, and then they were on the ring road. Tansy vaguely remembered this road. They had once come this way when Mum and Dad were trying to sell the air conditioners. "Can you turn the light on at the back, Mum?" she said. "I can't read anything." Mum swiveled in her seat. "The button should be above your head." Tansy reached up and clicked it with her thumb. She could have taken her gloves off, she thought. Mice couldn't walk upside down. Not like spiders. "It's not working." "Nicky, you'll have to map read." She looked over, exasperated. "Nicky!" "Yeah, I will. I just need to get these golden stars. They're 5,000 points." Tansy folded the map as best she could and pushed it back through the front seats. Nicky's head was bent low over his game, lost in concentration. To be fair, golden stars were really hard to get. "Will you put that thing down?" He sighed, snapped it shut. They were going past a pub she didn't recognise, and now a new hotel. Mum said they were looking for the M3, but Tansy hadn't seen any signs for the M3 for ages. Beside her, Norman started a low whine. She figured they had around 38 seconds before Mum said it was shredding her nerves. She made it to 27. "Tansy, please stop the dog. It's making it impossible to concentrate. Nicky, I really need you to read the map." "He's drooling everywhere. I think he needs to get out." She shifted to the side. Nicky squinted at the signs in front of them. "If you stay on this road, I think we'll end up in Southampton." "But that's the wrong way." "That's what I said." The smell of oil was really strong. Tansy wondered whether something was leaking. She put her glove over her nose. "I think we should just head back to where we were and start again." With a grunt, Mum swung the car off at the next exit. They all tried to ignore the grinding noise as she turned the wheel to the right and headed back down the other side of the dual motorway. "Tansy, please do something with the dog. Please!" One of the Rolls pedals was so stiff she almost had to stand up on it just to change gear. She looked up and pointed toward the turn-off for the town. "What am I doing, Nicky? Coming off here?" "Oh, God! He's farted! Mum, I'm suffocating!"
"Nicky, please, can you read the map?"
Tansy remembered now that Mum hated driving. She wasn't good at processing information quickly enough. She always said she didn't have the right synapses. Plus, to be fair, the smell now seeping through the car was so bad it made it hard to think straight. She began to gag. "Oh, I'm dying!" Norman turned his big old head to look at her, his eyes sad, like she was being really mean.
"But there are two turnings. Do I take this one or the next?" "Definitely the next. Oh no, sorry, it's this one." "What?" Mum wrenched the car off the motorway, narrowly avoiding the grass verge and onto the exit. The car juddered as they hit the curb and Tansy had to let go of her nose to grab Norman's collar.
"For Christ's sake, can you just..."
"I meant the next one. This one takes us miles out of the way."
"We've been on the road almost half an hour and we're further away than when we started. Jesus, Nicky, I..." It was then that Tansy saw the flashing blue light. She willed it to go past, but instead it drew nearer and nearer until those cold blue lights filled the car. Nicky swiveled painfully in his seat.
Jess, I think they want you to pull over."
"Shit! Shit, shit, shit! Tansy, you didn't hear that?" Mum took a deep breath, adjusted her hands on the wheel as she started to slow. "It will be fine. It will all be fine." Nicky slumped a little lower in his seat.
Jess?
"Not now, Nicky." The blue light was pulling over too. Her palms had begun to sweat. "It will all be fine."
"I guess this isn't the time to tell you I brought my stash with me."
Chapter 10. Jess. So there she was, standing on the grass verge of the motorway at 11:40 at night with two policemen who were both acting not like she was a major criminal, which was sort of what she'd expected, but worse. like she was just really, really stupid. Everything they said had a patronizing edge to it.
So are you often in the habit of taking your family out for a late-night drive, madam, with only one headlight working? Were you not aware, madam, that your tax disc is 2 years out of date? They hadn't actually looked up the whole no insurance thing yet, so there was that to look forward to.
Nicky was sweating, waiting for them to locate his stash. Tansy was a pale, silent ghost a few feet away, her sequin jacket glittering under the lights as she hugged Norman's neck for reassurance. Jess had only herself to blame. They could hardly get any worse. And then Mr. Nichols turned up. She felt the remaining colour drain from her face as his window wound down, and a million thoughts flashed through her head. Like, who was going to mind the children when she went to prison? And if it was Marty, would he remember things like the fact that Tansy's feet grew occasionally, and then would he buy her new shoes instead of waiting until her toenails curled in on her toes? And who would look after Norman? And why the hell hadn't she done what she should have done in the first place and just given Ed Nichols back his stupid roll of money? And was Ed about to tell the police that on top of everything else, she was a thief? But he didn't. He asked if he could help. Policeman number one turned slowly to look Ed over. Number one was a barrel-chested man with an upright bearing, the kind who took himself seriously and bristled if everyone else didn't do too. And you are? Edward Nichols. I know this woman. What is it, car trouble? He stared at the rolls as if he couldn't believe it was actually on the road. You could say that, said policeman number two. Out-of-date tax disc, Jess muttered, trying to ignore the hammering in her chest. I was trying to drive the kids somewhere, and now I guess I'm driving it home again. You're not driving anywhere, said policeman number one. Your car is now impounded. The tow truck is on its way. It is an offence under Section 33 of the Vehicle Excise and Registration Act to drive on a public road without a valid tax disc, which also means your insurance will be invalidated. I don't have any. They both turned towards her. The car isn't insured. I'm not insured. She could see Mr. Nichols staring. What the hell? The moment they entered the details, they would see it anyway. We've had a bit of trouble. I was desperate. It was the only way I could see to get the kids from A to B. You are aware that driving your car without tax and insurance is a crime? She stared at her feet. And carries a possible jail sentence. And it's not my car. She kicked at a stone on the grass. That's the next thing you're going to see when you do your whole database thing. Did you steal the vehicle, madam? No, I did not steal the vehicle. It's been sitting in my garage for 2 years. That's not an answer to my question. It's my ex-husband's car. Does he know you've taken it? He wouldn't know if I had a sex change and called myself Sid. He's been in North Yorkshire for the past... You know, you really might want to stop talking now. Mr. Nichols ran a hand over the top of his head. Who are you? Her lawyer? Does she need one? Driving without tax and insurance is an offence under Section 33... Yeah, you said. Well, I think you might want to get some advice before you say any more... Jess. Jess. He looked at the policeman. Officers... Does this woman actually need to go to the station? Because she's obviously really, really sorry, and given the hour, I think the kids need to go home. She'll be charged with driving without tax and insurance. Your name and address, madam. Jess gave it to policeman number one. The car is registered to that address, yes, but it's registered under a SORN, which means that it shouldn't be driven on a public road. I know. You know... Shame you didn't think about that before you came out, then, isn't it? He gave her the kind of look that teachers deserve for making eight-year-olds feel small, and something in that look pushed Jess over the edge. You know what? She said. You honestly think that I would have driven my kids anywhere at 11 o'clock at night if I hadn't been desperate? You really think I just sat there this evening in my little house and thought, I know, I'll take my kids and my bloody dog and just go and get us all into a whole heap of trouble and... It's not my business what you were thinking, madam. My issue is you bringing an uninsured, possibly unsafe vehicle onto a public road. I was desperate, okay?
And you won't find me on your damn database because I've never done anything wrong.
Or you just never got caught. The two policemen gazed at her steadily. On the verge, Norman flopped down with a great sigh. Tansy watched it all in silence, her eyes great hollows. Oh, God, Jess thought. All she sees around her now is chaos.
She bit back her words, mumbled an apology. You will be charged with driving without the appropriate documents, Mrs. Thomas, policeman number one said, handing her a slip of paper. I have to warn you that you will receive a court summons and that you will face a possible fine of up to £5,000.
£5,000?
Jess started to laugh. But you can go now.
£5,000?
And you'll need to pay to get this, the officer couldn't bring himself to say car, out of the police pound. I have to tell you that there is a £15 charge for every day that it remains there.
Perfect. And how am I supposed to get it out of the pound if I'm not allowed to drive it?
I'd advise you to remove all your belongings before the tow truck arrives. Once it leaves here, we cannot be held responsible for the vehicle's contents.
Oh, of course, because obviously it would be way too much to hope for a car to be safe in a police pound, she muttered.
But, Mum, how are we going to get home? There was a brief silence. The policeman turned away. I'll give you a lift, Mr. Nichols said. Jess stepped away from him.
Oh, no, no, thank you. We're fine. We'll walk. It's not far.
Tansy squinted at her, as if trying to assess whether she was serious, then clambered wearily to her feet. Jess remembered that under her coat, Tansy was in her pyjamas. Mr. Nichols glanced at the children. I'm headed back that way, he nodded towards the town. You know where I live. Tansy and Nicky didn't speak. But Jess watched Nicky limp toward the car and start to haul out the bags. She couldn't make him carry all that stuff home. It was at least 2 miles.
Thank you, she said stiffly. That's very kind of you.
She couldn't look him in the eye.
What happened to your boy? Policeman number two said as Nicky dropped his hold all at her feet.
Look it up on your database, she snapped, and walked over to the pile of bags. They drove away from the police in silence. Jess sat in the passenger seat of Mr. Nichols's immaculate car, staring straight ahead at the road. She wasn't sure she had ever felt more uncomfortable. She could feel, even if she couldn't see, the children's stunned silence at the evening's turn of events. She had let them down. She watched the hedgerows turn to fencing and brick walls, the black lanes turn to streetlights. She couldn't believe they had only been gone an hour and a half. It felt like a lifetime. A £5,000 fine, an almost certain driving ban, and a court appearance. Marty would go mental. And she had just blown Tansy's last chance of going to St. Anne's. For the first time that evening, Jess felt a lump rise in her throat. You okay?
Fine.
She kept her face turned away from Mr. Nichols. He didn't know. Of course he didn't know. For a brief, terrifying moment after she had agreed to get into his car, she had wondered if this was a trick. He would wait until the police had gone, then do something dreadful to pay her back for her theft. But it was worse. He was just trying to be helpful.
Can you turn left here? We're down there.
Go to the end, turn left, then the second turning on the right. The picturesque part of town had fallen away half a mile back. Here on Danehall, the trees were skeletal even in summer, and burnt-out cars stood on piles of bricks like civic sculptures on little pedestals. The houses came in 3 vintages, depending on your street. Terraced, pebble-dashed, or tiny, and built in maroon brick with UPVC windows. He swung the car round to the left and into Seacole Avenue, slowing as she pointed to her house. She looked round at the back seat and saw that during the short drive, Tansy had nodded off, her mouth hanging slightly open, her head resting against Norman, who leant half his bulk against Nicky's body. Nicky looked out of the window impassively. So where were you trying to get to?
Scotland, she rubbed her nose. It's a long story.
He waited. Her leg had started to jiggle involuntarily. I need to get my daughter to a maths Olympiad. The fares were expensive, although not as expensive as getting pulled over by the old Bill, it turns out.
A maths Olympiad. I know. I've never heard of one either until a week ago. Like I said, it's a long story. So what are you going to do? Jess looked into the back seat at Tansy, who snored gently. She shrugged. She couldn't say the words. Mr. Nichols suddenly caught sight of Nicky's face. He stared as if seeing it for the first time.
Yeah, that's another story. You have a lot of stories.
He turned back in his seat and looked straight ahead at the men on the corner. Jess couldn't work out if he was deep in thought or if he was just waiting for her to get out of the car.
Thanks for the lift. It was kind of you.
Yeah, well, I owe you one. I'm pretty sure it was you who got me home from the pub the other night. I woke up on my sofa with my car safely in the pub car park and the world's most malevolent hangover. He paused. I also have a vague memory of being an arsehole, possibly for the second time.
It's fine, she said, as blood rushed to her ears. Really.
Nicky had opened the car door. The cool air made Tansy stir. She rubbed her eyes and blinked at Jess. Then she gazed slowly around her at the car, the last hour re-registering on her face.
Does this mean we're not going?
Jess gathered up the bags at her feet. This was not a conversation to have in front of an audience.
Let's go inside, Tans. It's late. Does this mean we're not going to Scotland?
She smiled awkwardly at Mr. Nichols. Thanks again. She hauled her bags out onto the pavement. The air was surprisingly chill. Nicky stood outside the gate waiting. Tansy's voice crackled with sudden knowledge.
Does this mean I don't get to go to St. Anne's?
She tried to smile.
Let's not talk about it now, sweetie.
But what are we going to do? Said Nicky.
Not now, Nicky. Let's just get indoors. You now owe the police $5,000. How are we going to get to Scotland? Kids, please, can we just go indoors?
With a groan, Norman heaved himself off the back seat and ambled out of the car.
You didn't say we'll sort something out?
Tansy's voice was panicked.
You always say we'll sort something out.
We'll sort something out, Jess said, dragging the duvets out of the boot.
That's not the voice you use when we're really going to sort something out.
Tansy began to cry.
It was so unexpected that at first Jess could do nothing but stand there in shock.
Take these. She thrust the duvets at Nicky and leant her upper half into the car, trying to manoeuvre Tansy out.
Tansy, sweetheart, come out, it's late. We'll talk about this.
Talk about me not going to St. Anne's? Mr. Nichols was staring at his steering wheel, like this was all too much for him. Jess began apologising under her breath. She's tired, she said, trying to put her arm around her daughter. Tansy shifted away. I'm so sorry. It was at that point Mr. Nichols's phone rang.
Gemma, he said wearily, as if he'd been expecting it.
She could hear an angry buzzing, as if a wasp had been trapped in the receiver.
I know,
he said quietly.
I just want to go to St. Anne's, Tansy cried. Her glasses had fallen off. Jess hadn't had time to take her to the optician to fix them, and she covered her eyes with her hands. Please let me go. Please, Mum, I'll be really good. Just let me go there.
Shh. A lump rose in Jessie's throat. Tansy never begged for anything. She just wasn't made that way.
Tans.
On the pavement, Nicky turned away as if he couldn't watch it. Mr. Nichols said something into his phone that she couldn't make out. Tansy had begun to sob. She was a dead weight. It was as if she was refusing to leave the car.
Come on, sweetheart, Jess said, tugging at her.
She had braced herself against the door.
Please, Mum, please, please, I'll be really good.
Tansy, you cannot stay in the car.
Please.
Out.
Come on, baby.
I'll drive you, Mr. Nichols said. Jessie's head bumped against the doorframe.
What?
I'll drive you to Scotland. He had put down his phone and was staring at his steering wheel.
Turns out I've got to go to Northumberland. Scotland's not that much further. I'll drop you there.
Everyone fell silent. At the end of the street there was a burst of laughter, and a car door slammed. Jess, straightened her ponytail, which had gone askew,